Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Friends, if you know anything about me, you know that I love reading. I also love buying books. Those are two completely different activities as far as I'm concerned. And sometimes you read books that you've bought, and sometimes you have a ton of books on your bookshelf or even your nightstand that you want to read, but you still get the urge to just go to a bookstore and buy books and see all those books on the shelf at the store. Bookstores are really interesting places. They're places where all these different voices gather, these different kinds of people, and they face each other across the aisles through their works. And all these different ideas collected in this place. And the ideas are circulating. New books come in, old books go out. And they all also bring in art and design through the covers. And they're sectioned off in different and interesting ways in different stores. All that obviously is mediated by the bookstore and the booksellers, but it's also mediated by this huge business of publishing. Now, I really want to talk about bookstores at some point on this show, but before I get there, I wanted to talk about publishing as a sort of extension of the last episode I did, which was an episode with Sarah Maria Griffin on what it's like to be a working writer. Something that working writers have to deal with is that vision of having your book in the bookstore, and crossing through the the river of sorrows or the moat or whatever it is of publishing to get there. Publishing is a very confronting thing for writers, and it's also highly mystified. We, even as writers, don't really know a lot of the processes. We certainly don't know the histories of it. I wanted to talk with somebody who did, and I asked Professor Dan Senekin on to the show to talk about all of this via his amazing book, Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. That might sound very niche to you, but this book is a real page-turner. It's very exciting. And it's got lots of name-dropping in it, of course, and lots of gossip, but also has some theories about how we came to read and appreciate the sorts of things we read through maneuvers and moves made by publishers and decisions that were made by publishers around their bottom line, around aesthetics, around what is considered high art versus low art, elite, middle brow, and sort of mass appeal via mass market paperbacks. Lots of things spin out of this conversation, these considerations that Dan's making. So, for instance, you know, the imagination of being a writer, in especially in America, is all based on, for the most part, at least in the beginning, the idea that you can just be this massive success. There's that story that is modeled by Stephen King or Danielle Steele or John Grisham, that there's this working class writer who makes it big and becomes a millionaire and everybody knows their stories. I'm not saying that that's impossible. It certainly still happens from time to time. But why is it that that model is so embedded in people's minds when it's not the majority of what happens with most writers? But beyond it not being the course of events for most writers, it's also mostly the same five or six writers that we hold up that have had their careers around for decades, starting in the 70s and 80s up to this point. Not many people have made it since then in that way, and yet a lot of people still have that idea of being a writer. It always cracks me up when I watch a TV show or a movie that has someone that's a famous writer in it. Writers are infamously portrayed poorly in movies and TV. There's a complete lack of the sense of reality of a writer's life in other media forms, and usually they'll reach toward that model because people don't really know how much writers get paid. They don't know how decisions are made around publishing writers. They don't know that best-selling authors are selected and it's decided that they will become bestsellers. It's not usually just an organic phenomena in the way that we think, and this is all in Dan's book. Also, why are genres separated out? Why are fantasy novels and horror novels and romance novels and literary fiction, what even is literary fiction, all shelved differently? Where did those oppositions come from? Why are they not all sort of blended together? And why are some respected and others just completely dissed and criticized all the time? What have the effects been of multinational corporations buying publishing companies and merging publishing companies together and dissolving others? How does that affect what we read, what we think of books, what it's like to walk through a bookstore? How does that affect prizes? Why do so many prize-winning novels suck, frankly? When did identity become such a big marketing buzzword? Why are books marketed on authors' identities? This is all stuff that we talk about on this episode, and it's all stuff that Dan investigates in his book. I'm so excited to share this episode with you because not just as a writer, but as someone who just cares about art and culture, seeing that confrontation between the creative individual and the political realm and the economic realm that takes place in publishing, not just confrontation, but also the agreement, the alliance that happens, the cooperation. It's all very interesting and I think has a lot of relevance for the way art plays out in general. Obviously, as a writer, I want as little mediation as possible in a lot of ways. I want to just write the stories that I want to write, and then I want to give them over to somebody who believes in me, a publisher, and have them help me design it, distribute it, get it to people, and have us both be happy with the ways in which the public supports us in our efforts and through the appreciation of who we are and what we do in the world. But that's just not the reality of it. And I am very happy to say that mostly that is true with this podcast. And that's because the podcast is supported by Patreon, patreon.com/ConnorHabib. Do you like how I just sort of smoothly turned that into a pitch for my Patreon? But I really mean it in a genuine way. I'm so happy that there's very little interference with what I do on this podcast because it's just supported by listeners. So please do go to patreon.com/ConnorHabib. If you don't already support the show, you can pledge at any amount. You can give a one-time thing on an annual basis, or you can do it monthly, and there are benefits as well. So it means a lot to the show. It's what keeps it going, and it's what also allows me to just do this work without tons of interference. I don't have sponsors. I'm not trying to make this show absolutely massive. It's grown really on its own, and it's been able to grow because people like you, maybe you do support it on Patreon already, help it flourish. There are other things you can do in addition. One, just give the show a 5-star rating and warm review on Apple Podcasts. Makes a big difference about the visibility of the show. Also, buying and reading Hawk Mountain or getting it from the library and leaving a 5-star rating and warm review on Goodreads if you think it deserves 5 stars. And if you don't, you can always write a review without rating it. I am interested in what people have to say, but that does help the visibility of the book, and it starts conversations around the book and gets it in other people's hands, which I really love. You can also just subscribe to the show, have conversations about the show with people and the book. All right, that's that. I'm so excited to share this episode with you. I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed recording it with Dan Senekin, talking about big fiction. Here we go. Hi, everybody. This is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Hello, Dan Senekin.
Hi, Connor. It's great to be here.
Okay, so I think we'll just kind of jump right in. I mean, one of the things I love about your book, Big Fiction, is like it fleshes out something that I feel I'm constantly telling people about with writing, is that there's a difference between like writing and being a writer, and that being a writer requires navigating all sorts of insane things that you need a completely different skill set to engage with. And a lot of it is like even to someone who has those skills, like behind this curtain, and like your book is all on the other side of the curtain, which was really great. It actually gave me some sympathy and like compassion for people that I normally might feel a little oppositional with at times as a writer. So that was good. But let me just say that I think that people who are aspiring to be writers now, a lot of them have the image of what a writer is that's like really out of date or really represents just a few people. So because Stephen King and John Grisham and Daniel Steele are like the best known writers, I think some people still have an idea that that's this thing to reach for as a writer, at least until they, you know, get a little older or get a little more seasoned in it. Something that you point out in your book is that that group of people, which includes a few other authors as well, they were kind of not created, they're not like boy bands, but they were kind of like selected at a certain time. And like, interestingly, that kind of writer with that stature, with that many books out, it's still the same people from all that time ago. So I find that really interesting. So I want to talk about that, like the public imagination of being a writer that's informed by those big names and the way that they're marketed versus the reality of it. So maybe we could just start there, wherever you want to go with that.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of people in the United States who want to be writers. And there are only a very, very, very small number, I mean, minusculely small number, who make a living solely off being a writer. And we're talking about like all the people who even get published. So a minority of those hundreds of thousands of people, a small minority will get published. And then a very small minority of the people who get published actually make a living just working as a writer. The large majority of people who make a living, who publish their writing and are writers, either teach or they podcast or they or they have some, you know, some other job, or they married into money, or there's some way that they're getting supported financially that is not through their writing. So this image we have of the writer is someone who is kind of toiling away independently, full-time as a writer, sending their work in, getting paid, and like living that sort of like romantic life we imagine. That's just not really how it is. And to be perfectly honest, it really hasn't been that way in modern publishing going back a long, long time. You know, even folks like William Faulkner and F. Scott Fitzgerald had to go to Hollywood eventually and write scripts to pay their bills. I mean, both of them drank away a lot of their money, but they were trying to figure out their finances too, and those were, you know, top writers of their time. So but writing has gotten increasingly professionalized over the last few decades as well, and this all fits into one big larger story that I tell in Big Fiction about the conglomeration of the industry. But the problem that creates for publishers, if you're looking at this from the publisher's side of things, you're like, okay, I'm an acquiring editor and I'm trying to figure out which of these hundreds of thousands of writers are worth publishing. Well, there's no way you can read or even hire an assistant to read or glance at, you know, hundreds of thousands of manuscripts. And so in the last 50 years, the system has really created a number of gates for the gatekeepers to police. And one of those is literary agents. If you're working for one of the big five publishing houses that controls 80% of publishing, you have to work with an agent. The editor will only see stuff that an agent brings to them. And how is that agent going to get it? Well, the agent's likely going to be trying to filter a very large number of people who want to work with those agents by looking at creative writing programs. Creative writing programs are like, have become a professional way for writers to to train themselves, and more importantly than train themselves in writing, is to connect themselves with the network of people who will enable them to get a literary agent. And those creative writing programs really started to boom in the 1990s. They existed before then, but it became a kind of mainstream path to writing professionalization in the 90s. And there's a understood hierarchy among those, where Iowa was at the top, places like Brown, Cornell, Michigan, come kind of after that, Columbia. Literary agents will use that as their way to filter through the problem of abundance. Mm-hmm. And how do you get into MFA programs like that? Well, oftentimes it means you've gone to a strong undergraduate program, especially the Ivy League. And how do you get into the Ivy League? You're born within one of a handful of zip codes where you have parents who are legacies or have certain. So this, what I'm trying to point out is, like, you've got hundreds of thousands of writers in America, and the very tiny few get through. And those who get through, in most cases, were born into a certain degree of privilege.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Okay. So, so much to go on right there, already. I think, so maybe we'll start with, like, the, you know, writing as kind of gig work almost for a lot of people, or maybe it's artistic, aspiration, and then, like, they still have to do this other job or whatever. I mean, I've really wondered about that for a long time. Like, what would it take to actually just move everything over to writing in my own life? Like, I've been trying to figure out that problem for a little while now, and it's like getting there, but it's like it's taking its time, you know. It takes a while. I mean, if I don't include anything that came before the first, 40 some years of my life before the first book was published, it's still taking a long time since that to, sort of figure out this problem. And I mean, I think that people that are doing this other work, it's interesting the ways in which that other work figures into the kinds of books that are being written and what's being made and what the stakes are for people. So, mm-hmm. for instance, I was just thinking about, the way in which teaching informs in teaching in MFA programs, but in teaching English departments and so forth, really informs the way that people, the things that people write and the things that people write about, and they're trying to succeed in academia, and how much that theme comes up again and again in fiction. And then the ways different kinds of labor has started to show up more and more, it seems like, in fiction. But it's really interesting. So, like, in a lot of them, what I see, whether it's in an office or an MFA program or whatever, is there's one, like, the main character is the person who's, like, become really aware that the job they're in is, like, shitty, but, like, everybody else around them seems, like, kind of content or okay with it. Like, they're the kind of one lone person that's noticed. And yeah. That, like, that thing, you track it in a lot of authors. And you've talked about this on so many other podcasts. We don't have to talk about it specifically, but, like, you tracked in a lot of other authors who, basically are writing these, sometimes thinly veiled stories about people overcoming what their publishers have done to them. But it does seem like, in these other places of work, it's still that same trajectory where it's like, well, I'm the one that sees the problem here in this place, and I'm going to be the one who feels alienated in the workplace, and I'm going to overcome that. And so it's like this weird spill out into the writing of, like, resentment about the jobs that people have had to take that aren't just writing because of what you've described. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not surprising at all that that's the case, to be perfectly honest. Like, I think, so one thing I'm trying to push against in big fiction is this cultural romanticization we have of authorship, this idea that, creativity and the imagination are these things that liberate us from the material grind, right? And that this author is kind of this independent genius who brings us these beautiful narratives or stories or novels or whatever that then we get to enjoy, and that this the way we often talk about this and think about this as a society divorces it from the material realities, which I think is a mistake and an illusion. And so the fact that we're living in a moment where we're at the kind of end of and the continuing process of 50 years of wage stagnation and rising inflation and rising wealth inequality in this country. And people's jobs have gotten shittier over time. And it's been harder to make it as a writer over the last 50 years. And so the fact that people and the fact that people's daily realities, the things that they have to deal with and think about all the time are also things that are getting processed in their imaginative work.
Yeah.
Is not surprising at all. And so there's a you know, great book about what that looks like specifically for people whose daily job is to teach creative writing, called The Program Era, by Mark McGurl, which I would recommend to folks who are interested in seeing how, writers mediate their experience, as professors, into how that gets mediated into literary history over the last 50 years. But just in general, like folks, you know, in the book, I talk about E.L. Doctorow or Toni Morrison in particular as folks who worked in the publishing industry for a long time and then process that work in what I think are allegories of the publishing industry in major books that they wrote. I think it's healthier for us to collectively recognize, to stare the truth in the face rather than pretend. It's an American fantasy that we have that ultimately does the service of ideology to pretend that that there's this it's a salve for all of us, that art can be a salve from our difficult lives rather than a processing through the inequalities that capitalism delivers.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, I'll have to think through that with you a little bit more as we go on. I was, because I'm not sure where I land with it. I, like, obviously, like, I agree that that's true. And I'm trying, my mind is like searching for places in which that's, you know, not, or these kind of different, you know, spaces where that it just enacts itself differently. But as you were talking, I was also thinking about, you know, you as being a writer and the way in which, I mean, it's so weird, you know, anybody knows about academia knows the publish or perish, like, you know, cliche. But the way in which being a writer serves the function of your job. Now, I realize we're talking, it's mostly about fiction in your book, but I was thinking about the way that you also have to write, and it seems so much less glamorous in a way. But of course, I mean, there are a lot of academic books that are extremely, you know, potent and powerful and move people in the same ways that fiction, you know, popular fiction can move people. They might be harder for people to spot, or they might not know, but all of them is, or as many of them. But I do think like it must also serve your life being a writer. Is that, do you view that as in service to your job, or do you view your job as in service to the writing? Or maybe I know you'll probably say neither or both, but, or maybe not, but like, but what place does it serve for you then that you have to do this as a function of your job rather than people imagining and trying to make it their job only to finding that they have to have these other jobs anyway?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's a really good question, and it's a question that I am in possibly the worst person you could ask about it, because as I was writing Big Fiction, and it took, you know, years to write, and that's one of the privileges of being an academic, is that the kind of academic that I am. So I am an extremely privileged academic. 70% of classes taught in the United States are taught by adjuncts who, like, you know, are paid class by class and don't have an office or health insurance. But I'm a tenure track professor at a well-researched university. So I have the privilege to take time, to take years, and have research to support to write an academic book. So So I had the benefit of that in terms of my conditions of my labor. But as I was working on Big Fiction and talking to lots of people in the industry, reading their memoirs, looking at what they said in their memos and the archives, something that became axiomatic to me is that you can't trust what people's self-understanding. You know, I would always check the people, things people would say, their understanding of their situation against other people's understanding of sure. that person's situation. And so I'm embedded in a context that I'm blind to. There's
pressures. But I don't need that. I don't need the true answer. I just need the, you know what I mean? Like, I'm just kind of searching for the answer of your experience. You know what I mean? And we can,
Fair enough.
Sorry.
I mean, but then there's like, well, the first thing that comes to mind to me then is like the other thing I've learned going around doing podcasts and stuff after this book has come out is that most of the answers to the question like that are honestly, like, I think for if my experience, like anyone else's, are kind of a form of fabricated bullshit. Like, I don't necessarily, like, you know, I could tell you the thing that I've made up. I've got a couple of stories that I tell in answer to that question. But you know, those are questions that I'm like, I don't know really what I was thinking 6 years ago or whatever, 5 years ago when I was doing this. So I have to kind of, and it's made me look at every interview with an author differently, because I'm like, okay, they've got like one version of this story that they've learned how to tell. And writers are people who make up stories for a living. So like, they're pretty good at then making up a story about like why they wrote the book that they wrote, which is probably not the real reason they wrote it, but it's a nice story that they are able to tell. But anyway, one version of the story I tell, there's a couple things. Like one that I think is really true is that I was a contingent academic when I started this book. I was bouncing between temporary jobs, and I was really hungry to get a permanent job. And like, I just was like, if I get a book contract, that's going to help me. And an editor came to me, Philip Leventhal, phenomenal, the editor for this book at Columbia University Press. He saw a couple lines on my website saying like, oh, I'm thinking about doing a future project on the publishing industry. He's like, sit down with me at a conference and tell me about this, you know, tell me about this project. And at that point, I didn't have much I hadn't thought about it very much, but I did, give him 30 minutes worth of stuff. And he's like, get me a book contract. And I was like, I'm on the job market. I want to get a book. Or he's like, give me a book proposal and right, we can talk about a book contract. I whipped together a book proposal, sent it to him. He's like, all right, give me a sample chapter and an introduction. Got him that. And then we got a book contract. And then I got a job. So,
yeah. Well, so that, I mean, that's the... Yes, that's the version that you could definitely write about in your book about how the book came about, like the tracing the history of it. I think the reason why the question is interesting to me to ask you, I mean, I'm just as a site of like publishing, I mean, universities obviously are like massive like sites of like, you know, of publishing books. When someone's in an MFA department, as a professor, they have to go through a mostly completely different publishing process and have to try to make it in a different way. And in fact, some of the ranking of the MFA programs, it's like, who's your professor? That's the question that people, who teaches there? Now, of course, you ask that about other departments, but the way they're ranked, like UC Irvine was massive because Alice Siebold was the professor there for a while for creative writing. Obviously, that wouldn't necessarily be true now, but she was, you know, that's what made it big and still like in some senses with Iowa and some of the other programs. And it's because they've made it as popular writers, whereas the demand to create a popular book, I mean, it's just a completely different process in publishing. So I was just kind of like, I don't know, holding those two industries, I guess, up against each other for publishing and book creation, and also the way that academic presses, you know, a lot of them publish fiction as well. So just trying to think about the differing versions of it in your life and in mine, you know, to reflect on what other people go through. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, academic university presses, it's just such a smaller world than like trade publishing. So academic presses, you know, the bread and butter of most academic presses, university presses, are scholarly monographs. And these typically sell like 200 or 300 copies, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's how small potatoes we're talking. Yeah. And so the books are usually priced at like $120 and they're sold to university libraries. And that's kind of like the, and those are necessary to be published by scholars like me who need a book to get tenure. So that's kind of like how the system operates. And then those books another thing that's different about them is they have to be peer-reviewed. So the manuscript goes out to experts in the field, and thorough feedback is provided and revision happens before they get published. And, you know, they don't make money for the compensation for the people who write them, like me, is supposed to be in your salaried job. If you're lucky enough to be an academic with a salaried job, that's your compensation for doing the work and for, you know, the kind of spiritual compensation of being part of an intellectual community, insofar as that exists in a moment when the academic humanities are kind of in pretty dire straits and having trouble kind of reproducing themselves. And so, you know, there's, because it's so much smaller, there's a lot of, it's, you don't need a literary agent. You go to conferences in your field of expertise and there are book fairs where like the different presses have little booths like at AWP, and you can just walk up to the editor or you email them ahead of time and you arrange for a 30-minute meeting and you just talk to them, and you can do it kind of at any point in your process to kind of, you know, tell them the kind of stuff you're working on. And if you both agree it's a good fit, like you kind of just go forward with the process from there. So unlike mainstream publishing with a major press, you don't need a literary agent. You know, it's just a much smaller world and a much more casual world.
Yeah. I mean, I'm reflecting on that model as like, would that actually be a good model for fiction writers to have, maybe not the peer review process per se, but like, is there actually a working model there? But I guess the money, you know, like talk about not being able to make it as a, just a working writer. If that were the model, it would probably be impossible. But then I'm thinking about also how people who are in your position, if you wanted to write big fiction as a popular book, like weirdly, even if it were a bestseller, it might not qualify you for your position, which is completely absurd. You know, I mean, it reads very like easily, like it's a very easy read. It's like, I don't know if page turner is the right word for what it is, but like, it's exciting to read through. And so, that it could easily have been like a popular press nonfiction book, with maybe a little bit just more narrative of where you were located and in all of it or whatever, but that wouldn't have qualified seems completely crazy to me with just that little tweak. If, you know, St. Martin's Press or something had put it out whenever it came out or whatever, why is it so, is it just the peer review process that is the claim to that, to like not allow academics to be popular writers to substantiate their position unless they're in MFA programs? Or do you think that some other gatekeeping mechanism is what is really at stake here, or what's at play?
Yeah. So there, I'm trying to think the best way to access the answer to this question. So the peer review thing is really huge. In academia, there's a whole kind of scholarly apparatus that the academic books like including mine, include, with all the endnotes, all of the citations to hundreds of other texts, that embed a work of academic criticism in the huge infrastructure of scholarship. And that is a major difference between most trade nonfiction books, which occasionally do have some of that infrastructure, but they certainly aren't required to have it. And what you're being evaluated on as an academic when you go up for tenure, promotion, as I am currently, as we talk, I'm being evaluated for tenure at my university, is, you know, how is your work engaging in a field of scholarship and right. building on it valuably? And there's no way to evaluate that if you haven't gone through peer review. And so that's one piece of it. But there's the other side of it too, which is like if you're a trade press doing trade nonfiction, there's like agents who specialize in kind of bringing folks from academia into W.W. Norton or something, and bringing them over to the trade side. And there's like a small number, like most academics are academics and not trade writers for a reason, because they are happy to be erudite, happy to be difficult, happy to be, you know, to be more concerned with knowledge production than they are with prose. And that's not going to work. That's not going to sell more than 200 or 300 books. And so the Venn diagram of like academics and trade nonfiction writers, like the overlap is I think relatively small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm also just thinking of like the people who, especially it seems like a lot of anthropology books will have a kind of auto fiction quality, or like I'm thinking of some anthropology books that will have like poetry, like even like the writer mm-hmm. authors will write in poetry or whatever. And like, I'm just interested in why some of this passes through and some of it doesn't. I mean, I'm all in favor for the different forms coming through and trying to make an academic book appeal to a broader audience, but it's interesting to me. I think, okay, I'll step away from all of this and like, let's, maybe we can talk about Piers Anthony for a minute, because it's a totally different direction, because I too was obsessed with Piers Anthony when I was a kid and like, read all the Xanth novels and, well, not all of them, but a lot of them. And there was like these Incarnations of Immortality ones. Do you remember those? It was like on a
pale horse. I never read those. I might have read On a Pale Horse. You know, he's still writing them. He's got like a Xanth book coming out this year.
I didn't even know he's still alive. Well, amazing.
He's still alive and still publishing these Xanth books.
Wow. Okay. Well, you are definitely more in the punny world than I am. But I think that like I would still read them. I'd be interested to see if he's still following the formula that was laid down, which I didn't know he was following like this Del Rey formula. But then I think it was really interesting for me in reading your book was how you described the experience of going to a bookstore. It was exact same as mine. You would go and you'd see like the crazy painted covers, you know, and you kind of pick based on that. And then if you hooked into a series, like it was that, and there was it was Robert Asprin books for me, these myth adventure books. And I would read like all these fantasy and then sometimes horror novels. And then at a certain point, there was like a bridge like author for me. For you, it sounds like it was Thomas Pynchon, and for me, it was Donald Barthelme, like mm-hmm. something that contained some sort of fantasy or like fantastical element, but that moved me in and like into the more like literary world as I got older. It's so interesting to me that the the way that the books are marketed, at least for you know, a certain time period, marketed as being in completely different worlds. And then you and then I found a way to move from one world to the other by having this kind of like middle world. And it used to be that world was like sort of more experimental, but now that's the world that's being sold more and more. It's something that combines the genre with a literary or some other literary device element. Mm-hmm. So like you talk about romanticy, I mean, even like young adult, like fantasy.
Yeah. This is a vast change from when, you know, you and I were kids. Like, I think we're probably about the same age. I'm 40.
Yeah, I'm 46. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, similar. when we were kids, there wasn't this like massive, vast amount of YA. Like YA was like barely a category when we were kids. So like, so I moved from Xanth before I got to Pynchon, probably Vonnegut was, you know, like a crucial kind of transitional figure for me. Slaughter House 5 and Breakfast of Champions and then Joseph Heller, Catch 22, and then I got into Pynchon. You know, but it kind of moved from Xanth to Vonnegut. And now there wasn't like, you know, huge sections, you know, or now it's TikTok, book talk videos. And YouTube, and a huge, you know, marketing infrastructure and commercial publishing pushing, YA literature. And so that has created a context of generational divide. And so we see that's why it kind of bursts out in these, public fights often about, like, you know, some people defending adults reading YA, and because some people then end get into YA and never graduate from YA, they just read YA for the rest of their lives. And this becomes, you know, people fight, sometimes bursts out into like the New York Times, whether that's juvenile or, you know, whether we should defend forever reading YA. But it's also part of like a just like it's the thing that I'm always trying to think about in Big Fiction is like the things that we're seeing happening on the surface level have deeper infrastructural explanations. So the reason we were reading Xanth is fantasy was really, I thought when I was a kid reading Xanth, I thought, oh, fantasy must have existed forever, but it really only became a mass genre in 1977. And this was because of what was happening with chain bookstores and what was happening with the economy and what was happening with conglomeration and mass market books, and fantasy needed to fill a certain hole in order to make profits for quarterly growth for shareholder value for these big corporations. What's going on with YA and what's happening in the 21st century, what's happening in 2024 with romanticy, like this stuff is not an accident either. And it's part of what's happening is like the vast changes in how fiction is written and read in the era of Web 2.0, when you have user generated feedback and social media. And you've got Archive of Our Own, the fan fiction site that is, you know, vastly popular. Wattpad, which is a social media creative writing site that has tens of millions of monthly users, predominantly teenage girls and young women, writing YA and writing romance and writing fantasy. Where you have Kindle Direct Publishing, publishing, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of novels a year, self-published, that romance has become a world, like half of the books that are published or that are like received on Goodreads are like a straight up 50% are romance now. And romance is like a universe unto itself of micro genres and niche genres. And all of, so there's all of that happening in kind of the internet, Wattpad, AO3, KDP in the internet reading and writing. And then mainstream publishing is seeing what's going on there and seeing what a like huge readership there is for YA, for fantasy, for romance. You know, the romance and fantasy stuff in particular, the kind of the roots for that were planted in the 70s and 80s because of the history of the conglomeration of publishing, but it's now blown up on the internet. And then you've got, you know, Simon & Schuster will be like, okay, like, you know, there's profit to be made in YA, and then that's, you know, and so that's where the young people today move into that genre. But there's these, you know, kind of vast reasons why it is.
Just like at any point, like we could turn into like the Charlie Day meme with like the yarn across the board.
Because that's how I feel all the goddamn time. I feel like I'm that fucking meme. You know,
it's Big Fiction, man. I mean, it's interesting because in some ways, like, you know, what we're talking about and what's in your book, there's always this struggle between what is to be taken seriously, like what deserves the praise of like
and the weight of seriousness. So like, and what is the value of being popular? So yeah, so there's YA versus like adult works. In MFA, in the MFA program that I went to, there was like the author who's writing these, you know, more popular kind of novels. And then there was like the experimental one. They fucking hated each other. Like the two writers hate each other, and they have their like, you know, student apostles, you know, like on either side. There's like Ruby Carr versus like serious poetry. And, you know, then in academia, it's like, there's the peer review, like academic books versus popular nonfiction, which might be just as, you know, academically rigorous. Like all the standards of, you know, where we land on this is so interesting to me. And like that kind of struggle that's happening. And, you know, there's a really interesting moment in your book where you describe Stephen King getting this kind of being taken seriously, like getting this cultural elevation. I think in 2003, was it the National Book Critics Circle Award or what? It was,
I can't remember off the top of my head what it was, but he got some distinguished writing award.
Right. And Harold Bloom kind of grumbled about it. And at the same time, I remember that time because I worked at a Walden Books, I think when that, or maybe I worked somewhere. No, that must have been 2003. I must have worked somewhere else, probably at a bookstore in Amherst. But like, there was also like this praise of him, you know, that I think Laura Miller and Salon.com were like, sort of, he's the Dickens of our time. Doesn't anybody realize like he's, you know, this? And I think about that moment all the time. I mean, Stephen King's writing is like enjoyable to me, but I remember that as kind of being a turning. I like seeing the workings of it, but the turning of a valorization of a certain kind of popular novel that I still cannot actually, I don't know if it's good or bad, that I kind of can't get over that irritating me. Like I love it, but that cultural struggle is really interesting. I don't want to do like the Adorno thing where, you know, like, or, well, I don't want to do like the snobby critical theory thing where I either equalize or make them completely hierarchically distinct. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to find a better way to navigate that. You do really well to point out the cultural conditions that have led to some of that, but I'm wondering actually how you navigate that, because I'm still trying to figure that out. Like, what do we lend the seriousness and distinction to? It seems that there must be some, but I still can't quite figure it out. And of course, you know, my novel is genre. I mean, it can be a genre novel if you want to see it that way. And I love that about it. And I love horror novels. So, yeah.
So is the question like about like how I navigate it personally, or how I think about it like societally?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can talk about it on both levels. I mean, I'm sure the two are connected
I mean, it's so one of my favorite days in the courses that I teach is I teach a course called Introduction to Digital Humanities. And we do a section on social media and we do a day on Ruby Carr. And it's a really fun day because a lot of the students in my class, by the time they get to, it's a kind of 300 level, we have 400 up to 400 levels. So 300 level undergraduate course in an English department. Most of the time by the students get into that course, they've been trained that has a student at Emory in this classroom space. Someone like Ruby Carr is not someone to respect. But these students are also, you know, some of them, many of them, like, did have an attachment to Ruby Carr at one point, have family or friends currently, you know, peers who are not English majors who like love Ruby Carr. And so this brings up, you know, and it brings up very strong, the things that we attach to aesthetically, we often feel say a lot about who we are personally. And so what I do is I situate it in terms of the longer traditions of why we feel the way we do, and how like the classroom space that we're in, that you and I have both been in, that going through an MFA is partially what it does to you. Like the history of valuing literature that is difficult, that is stylistically complex, has a history in the rise of modernism in figures like Joyce and Woolf and Faulkner, and how they were valorized by critics in the early 20th and mid 20th century, and how that became the kind of norm in our educational system, and how that became part of how prizes are provided. And that is also all tied into kind of at a even more fundamental way, the fact that the cultural system is, you know, always, it always functions as a kind of competition for attention, and more people want to get read than can be read. And so there are different lanes that people can find themselves in. And one lane is to the lane of popularity, and another lane is the lane of privilege. And you have to find the place that you want to compete in one of those lanes or the other one of those lanes. Mm-hmm. And so, but then what that leads to is this sense that, like, oh, if I'm a person who enjoys modernist literature, difficult literature, complex, stylistic, prestigious literature, that makes me a deeper, more complex, more full human being. And then people who like popular stuff are going to resent that and feel condescended to, feel what's wrong with, like, you know, feeling deeply or being entertained. And yet, because it becomes so deeply embodied and so personal to each one individually, the people who love the complex literature are going to say and like feel that it makes them a deeper, fuller, more profound person, are going to be like, I can't, even if I can see systematically that this is historically produced, doesn't mean that I can't let go of it and feel like this isn't just fundamentally truer. And so that day in class when we're talking about Rupi Kaur, I can explain this to all of them, and still students are like, but Rupi Kaur like diminishes my sense of like the power of art, and like, you know, I can understand like the democratic impulse or whatever, and like, but and I can understand why like I've been created to be kind of the kind of creature that values the literature that I do love, and nevertheless, like, I just feel that this is true. You know, I just feel it is true that the literature I love is better. And that's how to be perfectly honest with you, like, I am such a creature. Like, I was, you know, deeply formed by reading Gravity's Rainbow when I was 17. Mm. Like, much of the person that I became and the life that I've lived, the person who wrote Big Fiction, like, was the kid who found, the teenager who found Gravity's Rainbow on the Barnes & Noble bookshelf and thought it was a big discovery, and like went and got obsessed with it, and like that language became part of me, and like, and the valuing, loving that language became part of me. And like, you know, it's not to say that I can't read some Daniel Steele books and like get a kick, you know, but I also, you know, I have a kind of ability to have Catholic taste and to be ecumenical, but like at the end of the day, I'm also going to, you know, it's going to be impossible for me to separate myself from my love for Bartle.
Well, I think there's like this distinction of like, how do I say this? Something in your book that was really, like, really good for me to read. Like, my boyfriend's a bit younger than me, and like Lord of the Rings is just like fucking where it's at for him, you know? But at least for a while longer, unless we started dating, he wouldn't have read anything that wasn't really fantasy, probably. And yet he was like completely open to it after, and now he like reads all kinds of stuff. He probably would have done that on his own. It just would have taken longer for him. I don't know. But I think that there's like a quality of opening up that I think is maybe a little important, like that, that I don't see. Now I have to question about why I think this is so important. The fact that, you know, reading comics and reading the Xanth novels and all the other, you know, things that I read really was encouraging to me to open up to other kinds of novels and new experiences. Why I brought up the Lord of the Rings thing with my boyfriend was, you helped me understand, like, because you just put them right next to each other. Like, well, people were reading Catcher in the Rye as like the coming of age story, but then they started reading Lord of the Rings. And I was like, oh, right. Like, I was kind of like irritated with my boyfriend for not knowing Catcher in the Rye, which is completely stupid because he was born and raised in Ireland. So why the fuck would he know Catcher in the Rye? But I was like, oh, I don't have to actually see these things as opposed at all. These are very similar stories. What's important to me is the ways in which they could open up to the other by seeing that there is some sort of like similar gesture in them. That was very exciting to me because it just helped me. And I think your book does it a lot. Like it just helps kind of erase some of these distinctions, but not because the distinctions aren't important or valuable or reasonable even, but the ways in which they really block out desires to look into anything else. I think that was what was really exciting. The ease with which you might be able to read Danielle Steele and then read something else, I think is important. I do think that that openness really does something worthwhile. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I'm trying to figure it out.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think what I'm trying to do is, you know, take each aesthetic object seriously on its own terms without at the same time forgetting that they are commodities too. Yeah. And that they're commodities that are situating themselves on, you know, different among different audiences and different spectrums on the scale from popular to prestigious. And that like, we tend to take someone like Stephen King or Danielle Steele and say, well, it's, you know, kitsch or trash. It's like, it's, you know, it's the categorically as like a aesthetic category. It's cranked out by a large corporation to sell a million copies and be entertainment for the masses. This would be the kind of culture industry Adorno bit. And then we say that, you know, something like Biography of X by Catherine Lacey is, you know, not, we don't think of it as a commodity. We think of it as art, right? Even though it is a commodity too, and it was produced by FSG, which is owned by, you know, the same kind of big five company that produces Danielle Steele. I guess I'm trying to look at these objects. I'm trying to do the modernist move of shaking us free of our preconceived, well, like the kind of screen that we come to these cultural objects with from the culture, and kind of shake that screen off so we can see them freshly and see that Danielle Steele, yes, is writing a mass market commodity that is designed to sell a maximum number of copies, but that's like not the only thing it does. And that it's interesting also to understand that Danielle Steele is a living human being who imagines herself an artist, and in the process of her career, which has changed dramatically over 50 years for really fascinating institutional reasons, that she has been like writing a kind of her own narrative of her aesthetic autonomy into these objects in ways that produce weirdnesses, like things that are not like, these books are like extremely weird in ways that can be totally fascinating to spend a little more time with. And they can be like campy, and they can be funny, like purposefully. They can also be like unintentionally weird, and they can just be pleasurable to be around and not just disregarded as like hollow cultural entertainment trash.
Yeah. I mean, as an author who's had to navigate these questions in conversation with a publisher, your book's really helpful. If nothing else, for a lot of reasons, but if nothing else, for the reason that it's helping me stare down some of these questions and think about new ways to address them. Like, so, you know, I wrote my novel, and it's like, it's some places marketed as horror, some places marketed as literature, some places marketed as a thriller. And I had to have all those conversations with the publishers, and it was very difficult. It was like the moment the question of engaging with the publisher came up about, where do you want this? You know, and of course, what are the comps, which is something you go over in your book a lot, is this question of comps, like in the selling it to the publisher and then the selling it to the public afterward. What are the comps? I had to face all these questions of kind of like, how seriously do I take this? What do I regard as serious? What are other people going to? Do I want to say things like, well, this is a literary horror novel? Or do I want to back away from that and let it just be a horror novel? Or does it not belong there at all? Because all the feeling life that comes up in relationship to these questions as a writer, it's so intense.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because like, because we like one thing that has happened increasingly as the publishing industry has been rationalized in the last 50 years, and we've gotten in increasingly like specific marketing categories, and these marketing categories are also like identifications that are tied into how like people think about their community and themselves. And so, you know, that means that people who like genre horror are going to think you're condescending if you insist on calling it literary horror. And that's something that you as a human being have to live with. At the same time that this is also like a decision about like trying to sell your book as like, you know, the best way that you can. And so you're trying to, as an author, you're trying to, you kind of have to hold two things in the air at once. One is what are the communities you want to be involved with? Like what, how do you want to be recognized and valued? And the second one is like, you know, your publisher wants to sell as many books as possible. And you probably want to sell a lot of books too. And so like, you know, what's going to operate best in terms of like maximizing your market share to be, you know, and it's, and there's like, it's no author wants to, this is one of the things that, especially when talking with authors in my book, like that authors are really untrustworthy on, is because for reasons that are perfectly understandable, no author wants to think of themselves making cynical calculations about selling the most amount of books that they can. I mean, maybe not no author. There are certainly some authors who want to think about selling as many books as they can. But you know, many authors are going to like want to think of themselves more as being concerned about what they value and their intellectual community and their artistic community and their art, and not about sales. And yet, you know, that there's a bit of necessary self-delusion there, because every writer wants to be read, and to be read, you have to sell books and you have to kind of win at the game of gathering attention. And so there's this constant, for the author, there's this constant kind of walking this fine line psychologically, socially, in terms of self-branding on social media, et cetera, of being like, how do I maintain a sense of my personal integrity, even as I'm like inevitably, impossibly embedded, like in this like extremely like calculated economic environment.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I think it's really, that's something that artists know so much about, but aren't asked about directly in that way as often as maybe we could be, which is like that question of, you know, I mean, just the sort of basic cliche version of it is like, how do you, you know, justify your actions within a capitalist system? Are you always reinforcing that system? Are you, you know, like, can you actually break free from it? Is there a transcendence from it? Are there spaces where it doesn't exist in your life? Or are you always playing back into it? How can you say that you want the system to change if you keep, you know, artists like are always dealing with that. Everybody's dealing with that. But artists, like, I think are like have that feeling of acutely dealing with it, because it's where the cultural realm and the political and economic realm come into like intense confrontation, just in by virtue of wanting someone to see or read, you know, read your work or see your work or hear your work, you know, your work, right? Your efforts.
Yeah. Your the labor that you have. So, and this, to circle kind of all the way back and try to be a little more complex about where we began on this question of like, you know, trying to stop romanticizing authorship and realize that the author is embedded in their material conditions. To be a little more thoughtful, maybe a little more dialectical about it. Like there's a tension. Sometimes I think about it as a tension between freedom and necessity, where necessity is like, you know, the marketplace, the material conditions, the work you do with your, the work the publisher is trying to do with your work as a commodity. The intense competition for any book to succeed that you have to be part of, that's all the necessity. And the freedom is your realm of imagination, your realm with engagement in art and the history of art, and what you're doing in your work to try to exceed the constraints. So any writer is working within certain constraints. And if you're a horror writer who's trying to do, you know, something that could potentially be called literary horror, at some level, your understanding, you've through your decades on this earth and through your MFA program and through reading other horror writers, you've internalized the constraints of that genre and the marketplace for that genre and how what you do stylistically in your book is going to affect the kind of reception that you are setting up for yourself. And those are also constraints of necessity. But what you're also doing is you're trying to exceed the economic and aesthetic constraints that you are forced to work within. And when that happens, you know, it extremely beautifully. So like in Toni Morrison's Beloved, she's working within constraints, but she's also exceeding those constraints in one of the most powerful ways that it's ever been done in American literature. So there's this constant kind of like, and but also Danielle Steele is trying to like embed her own freedom as an artist into these like extremely mass market commodities. And so what I would kind of revise myself from saying from back at the beginning is that reading the struggle between freedom and necessity back into our literary texts and recognizing that people are working through labor and their material conditions, but they're also in part trying to work through that in an attempt to free themselves, if inevitably only partially. And that's kind of how I read aesthetic objects in the novel, and I think is a really powerful way to think about what art does today.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I just want to change track here a little bit, a lot of it, but also a little bit. Like, I don't know if you did any research on John Brockman while you were doing, like, learning about some of the publishing stuff, where he's like the big popular science editor. And he, I studied science in grad school as well with one of his like sort of the scientists he adored, Lynn Margulies, and she like was like, he's a total phony. Like, he's a complete phony. He doesn't know anything about science at all. In fact, he kind of had this book ghost written for him called Frankenstein, Gertrude Stein, and Wittgenstein or something like that. That's like supposed to be this big history of ideas. And it was so obviously bad that they like shredded a lot of the copies and like never really came out. But he had gotten all these, like, he's the sort of hit maker for popular science. And the interesting thing to me about using him as a figure and not talking about fiction is that actually the perceptions of reality itself are based on this individual's curatorial selections of who should be famous. And so, you know, like, so he, you know, basically, you know, Richard Dawkins, some of the other big writers who may, well, in the case of Dawkins, definitely, but like some of the other ones as well, like it come up with these completely like wild and incorrect like scientific theories about how things work. And then we're just so embedded in the popular imagination that even though there's been like decades of, you know, research in evolutionary and organismic biology that completely refute his theories, everybody still believes in that version of how it works. And that creates these like, you know, cultural conditions where, you know, religious fundamentalists are able to completely tear apart his theory because it's wrong. And then people then get more embedded in their side. And so I think, you know, you point out in your book, basically that like a single person in publishing can make a massive difference. It's like this one place where you can have these really pivotal moments that kind of center around one figure that's quite identifiable in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Which is its own interesting thing. But I don't, I'm not sure people understand how high the stakes are for the curatorial, the curatorial conditions in some cases, of these people who are trying to decide and actually are quite unqualified in a lot of cases to decide who gets to be the popular face that represents this or that topic.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, that's exactly right. The thing I would just note is that even those people who are the curators, who are acquiring editors or executives with a lot of power, are themselves kind of working in this much larger environment where from above them, they've got certain structural demands around, you know, shareholder value, and below them, the stuff that would even ever reach them, has to pass through probably in most cases is passing through, as we talked about earlier, like, you know, MFA advisors and literary agents and so on and so forth. But the nonfiction thing, the trade nonfiction thing, stuff like, you know, Jared Diamond's Guns, yeah, Germs, and Steel, or like, you know, there's so many cases of it. You know, that the most popular podcast in America for a bit anyway was That New If Books Could Kill, because there's just like, they're like, we have okay. to like, because it's so, you know, there's so many of these books that get huge on grift. I mean, there's just like a huge ability to, like, you know, have basically grifter ideas become like treated and recognized as just the status quo. And it's fundamentally about, like, you know, what are the kind of forms of books that publishers know are going to sell millions of copies and make them money. It's not about, is this a true account of how the world works? I would love, I didn't, you know, my book's focused on fiction and I have an intimate understanding of how this plays out on the fiction side of things. I didn't do any investigation into nonfiction, and I would love to see, like, how sausage gets made on that side of things.
Yeah, it'd be really exciting. I mean, I think there are some versions of it, but they tend to really hone in on one topic. Like, I'm thinking of Thomas Lacker's like great book Solitary Sex, which is like about how basically masturbation became demonized because of this one dumb pamphlet that became like hyper popularized by a hoaxer and, you know, got adopted in all these like power plays. I mean, that's only a little fragment of what that giant book is about, which is a great book, but like, and that's way back when. I mean, this is, yeah, just
MSG is another one. There was like one article about MSG in like the '80s or something that said MSG was like bad for you. And then, you know, science journalism took off with it. And like, you know, probably like, you know, some like dark Dateline segment about MSG. And then everyone thought MSG is like terrible, but like, oh, it turns out that was bullshit and MSG is delicious and not bad for you.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just really interesting then, like comparing these things side by side. Like, I mean, obviously people take in sort of ontological and reality claims and stuff like that from fiction as well, but it's much lesser extent. Like, it's really the aesthetic dimensions, which might actually ready people for the acceptance of certain political or scientific ideas or whatever. But the way that the aesthetics are created, one of the things that you write about is autofiction. And that's really interesting to me. I was a little like kind of, I wasn't familiar. I guess it's just defined in a lot of different ways. Autofiction is just defined in a lot of different ways. But there seemed to be like, it was characterizing like John Barth and Maxine Hong Kingston and stuff like that as autofiction, which is interesting because I think a lot of the way that people think about autofiction now is something more like someone who's writing just basically a memoir, but has like fictional, I mean, those were two, but writing a memoir that's like hyper personal, that has like these slightly fictionalized elements, that is much more, it's not like the things they carried so much as it is like, well, I'm trying to think of a good example, but it's like someone moving to New York with like annoying downstairs neighbors and like,
Ben Lerner's 1004.
Okay, great. Yeah. That's a great example. So like, and I have to admit, it gave me a little bit of a thrill, which is like probably not great. I was that you indicated that autofiction best plays into conglomeration publishing in a lot of ways, because I don't like most current day autofiction. Now, if you took me back to John Barth or something like that, I might like it a little bit. And certainly Maxine Ong thinks that I might like it a little bit more. But a lot of how it plays out today, and the crossover, and this is kind of where I want to go with you, the crossover into the kind of hyper-personalized journalism, of which I used to do some, or think pieces, or autobiographical, like victim trauma pieces that were mm-hmm. super popularized, that turned into lots of book deals in the past 10 years or whatever. I'm just tracing that sort of line from that kind of fiction and autofiction into those kinds of pieces, which are now deeply informing how publishing works as well, and who gets selected to write novels, fiction, and nonfiction, memoir, and even political books.
Yeah. So there's so many different ways that someone could come at this. The big picture thing is that, any writer trying to make it is working within, as we talked about before, like you have a certain number of paths that are open to you at any given time that publishing houses, depending on which publishing, where you want to situate, do you want to publish with a tiny little publisher? Do you want to try for the big five? There's certain things that are working and that are treated as common sense as working. And so once autofiction gets the name autofiction, and there starts to be works out there by Sheila Hedy and Ben Lerner and Olivia Lang and Rachel Cusk, then this becomes like a path that people can follow. And there's the question of like, why did that become useful to publishing in the first place? Why did that take off? You could answer that in a lot of ways. One is that we've got a kind of hunger for a prestigious version of reality TV. You want to kind of see the kind of real life of the author and who they're living with and what their friends are like. And, you kind of want the gossip, you kind of want to, we've got this addiction to kind of what is the real life of these people? Even if we know that reality fiction and reality TV and auto fiction are both highly constructed and highly mediated and certainly not real and not true, they give us a kind of fantasy of getting into the people's lives. One thing that they also do, I think, is there has the publishing industry has become increasingly rationalized, and has personal branding has become one way to successfully work within that rationalized system. The autofiction serves authors as a way to kind of dilate the personal brand and thus give it some more nuance and complexity to describe themselves with subtlety that you can't do in 280 characters on Twitter. And it also for the conglomerates where, there's all of these market industrial reasons for why any book succeeds at a given time and for all the influences that go into it. But the conglomerate does not want that. That's not sexy and that doesn't sell. So the conglomerate wants to publish fiction that elevates, that still wants to romanticize and elevate that figure of the author. And so what could be better at elevating and romanticizing that figure of the author than making the author the star of the book, the protagonist? Mm-hmm. And so autofiction works both for the writer trying to defend their own, kind of to present their character as a rich, complex, rounded character rather than a thin, flat brand. And the industry that wants to use that thus complex brand as a kind of billboard to advertise the romanticization of the romantic author.
Yeah. Well, when I'm thinking about a lot of books that have won the Booker Prize or whatever recently, or some of the books that are really marketed and pushed out, there's also this weird combination of somehow including the author and the author's identity, usually like a racial identity, gender, expression, sexuality, whatever it might be, somehow into the marketing process to kind of fold that into how the novel appears. So this was something, again, I had to add a lot of talks about. It's funny. I just watched American Fiction last night. And I was like, oh, this is what I've, I've never read Erasure, but like, this is something I even wrote an essay about it for this literary magazine here in Ireland about, like, you know, the why, you know, it's like, yeah, you can't be neutral on a moving train, but why are you always asking people who are the most affected by the train to write about the fucking train all the time? Like, I'm tired of it, you know? And so, like, that was something, you know, in marketing discussions with Norton, I had to be like, no, I love them, by the way. I just nothing but really positive experiences with them. But there was a lot of conversation about, like, is this book about toxic masculinity or like queer identity or like whatever? And I was like, no, none of that goes in there because I don't want people to take it that way. But there's a way in which, even if it's not out of fiction, the identity of the author is somehow like intensely folded into the process of how the book is like sold and what the true story of the book is, so that we're supposed to deeply feel the experience of the author, even if the author's experience isn't really located somewhere in the novel. And
unless unless that writer is a straight white guy, in which case their identity is not part of any of the marketing.
That is the dispassionate scientist in the lab who objectively like writes everything down without having any subjective experience or opinion on the thing. It's like there's some sort of weird, like, that fiction is somehow objective.
This has been a steady progress for several decades, and I'm glad we're getting a chance to talk about this before we're done. I mean, it's the rules of the game for non-white, non-male writers are different and constrained in very specific ways. If you're a Black writer, I mean, it changes over time. After Beloved, there's a great book out, a relatively new book out by a guy named Alexander Manchel, called Writing Backwards. And he presents a really convincing account. He gets lots of the data on this about how after Beloved, published in 1987, that really created a template for Black writers, other non-white writers, to have success writing historical fiction, which is ubiquitous now, but it used to be like Gone with the Wind, you know, is kind of more what historical fiction used to be, a little more like sentimental, these kind of sweeping middle brow, you know, James Michener or Leon Uris. They weren't necessarily like the kind of prestigious literary fiction we see today. And that Toni Morrison opened a door for specifically non-white writers to get prestige by writing historical fiction. And other folks have talked about how there's particularities to that historical fiction. It should be, ideally, there's a trauma, a historical trauma at the base of it, that there's a kind of pseudo faux anthropological quality to it. That it ultimately is a kind of writing that will serve the masochism of a white liberal audience that wants to feel good about reading a non-white writer, especially the publishing industry imagines its primary readership as white women. And so non-white writers writing a kind of historical trauma, genealogical story that will satisfy that kind of readership. And so that became like one like specific and, you know, like relatively narrow path that commercial presses wanted to find non-white writers to like write in and elevate, and has become present everywhere. And then as that has increased in the 21st century, it becomes increasingly the case that we want those commercial publishers want to leverage the identity of the author as part of the marketing campaign. And so someone like Percival Everett, Percival Everett is a whole nother story. I'll just stop there for now.
Well, I mean, it's interesting the ways that people grapple with this. So like, so one thing I saw a lot of in the past few years was a lot of gay writers saying that Well, isn't it great that we can now, I won't say which books are referencing, but isn't it great that we now have books that aren't just about gay trauma, that they're about mm-hmm. gay joy? And I'm like, but this is so fucking reactive. Like, mm-hmm. why is this even like, as if this is somehow breaking free from the constraints that have been laid down? I forget the phrase you use, or exceeding the limits or whatever it is, transcending the limits of it. It's actually just staying completely confined and bound to the terms that have been set, and like ceding ground to the argument that's already in place. Beyond the identity qualifiers that publishers are looking for marketing, there is always some piece that makes sense. So like a lot of the translations that are happening where it's, you know, primarily white people in translation, it's still like about fucking war. Like it's always like, it's like another war novel from this country or that country. You're rarely getting things in that, at least that I can see, that aren't having as some touch point that like didactic, informative aspect. And so it becomes this weird thing where fiction writers aren't really allowed to write fiction. We're allowed to write nonfiction that has a fiction form that's meant to instruct people.
That's right. You're bound by, you're told to write to the identity that you're going to be recognized as a market category. And that's the kind of story that you're most likely to be acquired for writing. And so that's, you know, that puts like really fucked up constraints on the kind of work that gets published. And what happens is like writers find creative ways to fuck with those constraints and still get published. And that's where the good work is. I think it's really important to point out that there are really different constraints if one is dealing with one of the big five publishers, or if one is dealing with anything that's not one of the big five publishers. So you wrote with W.W. Norton, which is a really interesting case. They're a really big press. They're one of the very few independent presses that can actually like swing with the big boys. But they don't have quite as much capital as the big five, and they're weird. They, for totally contingent historical reasons, they're employee-owned co-op that has some freedom to do a little bit different stuff because they've got a really strong relationship with higher education, with their literary anthologies that like serves as something of like a sugar daddy a little bit that means that they're going to be able to pay the bills. That means that on their fiction and poetry side, they don't have to be as constrained to the bullshit as the big five publishers. And then, you know, on the other side of Norton, there's tons of small presses, small nonprofit independent presses that are constrained in their own way. They're always, there's no pure place in publishing, is what I like to say. And everyone's constrained in different ways. But your little nonprofits, your Hub City Presses in South Carolina, your Deep Vellums that is doing a lot of translation in Dallas, Texas, or your old school nonprofits now, the Minnesota ones, Milkweed Coffee House, Grey Wolf, they've got donors, they got funders, they got the government who's paying them, and they have to keep going back to that money. And there's ways that shapes the kind of aesthetics of what they're publishing. But nevertheless, they've got some freedom from the kind of market bullshit that the big five are more pressed to deal with. And so, you know, Deep Vellum's publishing all sorts of translations. I'm reading Solenoid right now from Deep Vellum, and it's super fucking weird, and it's great.
I mean, I think everything in this conversation and everything in your book, it's like, it just points to how like insanely fucking complicated this thing is that I think a lot of us as writers, I'm speaking for writers, but a lot of us want to be very simple, which is, you know, I write a book because I love reading and I love stories and I love writing. Maybe even there are a few of us that actually even love the act of writing. And then I have to feed it into this insane thing that, like, you know, it's shape and gears, like, look like what a fax machine sending a fax sounds like. There's a crazy, like, high-pitched, blippy static that has to be, like, navigated. And I think it's just really helpful. And I'm not sure if you knew how helpful this book would be for writers, it's a very helpful thing for writers to read. Very useful. And it creates some compassion too. Like, fucking thank God that is not my job. Like, being on that side of things, because that's a fucking rush too. That's crazy. So I want to tell you that is helpful. And I just want to say thank you. And also, it's just great. Like, it's a great fun, you know, to read as well. So, and we didn't even get to talk about all the other things you've written or close reading or that sort of stuff, but maybe sometime soon, Dan Sinekin. Thank you.
I would love to come back anytime. This has been a pleasure, and you know, thank you for saying what you said and for the attention to the book. It really means a lot.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you everybody for listening. Bye now.